while Virginia is not a central location of the events that occur, parallel events to almost everything that is described in my book also occurred in Virginia, what I call neo-slavery subsequent to the Civil War, which extended deep into the 20th century and affected the lives of millions of African Americans.
Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Our speaker today is Douglas Blackman. Doug Blackman is the Atlanta bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. His day job requires him to cover not only institutions in the Atlanta area like the Centers for Disease Control, the World Health Organization, and others, but also more than 1,200 companies like Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, Delta, Bank of America, Wachovia, Wells Fargo, UPS, and FedEx. Additionally, he is responsible for covering every bank in the United States that is not headquartered in New York City. So he covers some of the biggest and most important banks in the country. His stories, or the work of those in his bureau, have been nominated by the Wall Street Journal three times for the Pulitzer Prize. But Doug Blackman also has another job, and that is, having grown up in Mississippi, he has been intrigued by stories involving race relations for many years. When he was a reporter in Atlanta, he wrote a number of articles dealing with race relations in Atlanta, and he has spent almost a decade doing the research for a book called Slavery by Another Name, The Re-enslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II, which is an important book and one well worth reading. Please welcome Doug Blackman.
Good morning, and thank you all. Thank you for coming out. Thanks especially to George and to the Miller Center for having me. It's a terrific pleasure to be here. It's my first time to come to the campus of the University of Virginia, and though I was at Monticello as a child a few times, and looking forward to going back again this afternoon. It's also appropriate to come to Virginia to talk about the book, Slavery by Another Name, because while Virginia is not a central location of the events that occur, parallel events to almost everything that is described in my book also occurred in Virginia in terms of this resurrection of a kind of what I call neo-slavery subsequent to the Civil War, which extended deep into the 20th century and affected the lives of millions of African Americans. But it's also worth noting that the first words in my book come from George Mason and the Virginia Constitutional Convention in 1773, that begins, "Slavery, that slow poison, which is daily contaminating the minds and morals of our people." And in many respects, this book is about slavery as a slow poison and a kind of poison which we have hoped and believed had been expunged from our body as a society, but which I think the book, I hope, persuasively demonstrates was not expelled from our social body for many decades after when we thought it was, and still poisons us in many respects today. There are other Virginia connections as well. A key character in the book is a man named Thomas Dixon, who was the author of a book called The Klansman, which became the basis of the movie Birth of a Nation, the first mega film in American history, which we're all familiar with. And Dixon had many associations with Virginia and the University of Virginia. He was close friends with Woodrow Wilson, who was a graduate of the law school here. And the two of them and many others, their point of union really was the very venal white supremacy that both of those men, even though we remember Wilson for all of the much finer aspects of his personality and beliefs, but he was in fact a raging white supremacist, as was Dixon, and also through the Kappa Alpha Order at the very beginning of the 20th century, which has its roots at UVA and in that period of time had a very white supremacist cast to its character. But then also in Virginia, where the Tredegar Iron Works, which I do in Richmond, which I talk a little bit about in the beginning of the book. And Tredegar was really the place where a new kind of slavery was really invented in America prior to the Civil War. And it's a kind of slavery that has been understudied by academics and is largely forgotten. But the industrial slavery, which on which Tredegar Iron Works was based, where 500 African Americans worked as slaves in the years before the Civil War and up until essentially the fall of Richmond, making the majority of the munitions which were used by the Confederate forces during the war, until Alabama came to replace the Tredegar Iron Works and to replace Virginia as the primary location where cannon-grade iron and rifle barrels could be made. And again, all of that was done by slaves. And in a setting of industrial slavery that was very much patterned after what was happening in Richmond before the war, and which was a key element of the kind of neo-slavery that evolved and metastasized across the South after the Civil War. But one of the men who was affected by that new kind of slavery that emerged after the war was named Green Cottonham. And he is the central character in my book, which is built around a family of slaves who lived on a plantation in the middle of Alabama prior to the war, began with an Africa-born slave whose name was Scipio, and Green Cottonham was his grandson, born after emancipation. And the book is built around the emancipation of those slaves and then the ways in which this new slavery levered back on their lives over succeeding generations and the effect that it had on them. And it's exactly 100 years ago this spring that Green Cottonham was arrested for no apparent reason near the train station in Shelby County, Alabama, and charged with a fictitious crime, an event which would soon lead to his debasement and death under horrifying circumstances, and would wipe out a life that should have extended deep into the 20th century, a life that should have enjoyed the fruits of America's emergence as an economic superpower, should have witnessed the liberation of the civil rights movement, should have given birth to grandchildren and great-grandchildren who should be among us today, could be students at the University of Virginia. Before I read a passage from the book, let me go ahead and address in some manner, some questions that come up with almost every audience that I encounter. One of them is, why would I write this book? Why would a white kid from Mississippi who works for Rupert Murdoch at the most conservative newspaper in America write a book like this? And also, I'm sometimes asked, what's with my name? There's no answer to that one. The answer to that, and George referred to this, was that I've been a reporter now for 25 years. I've been writing since I was a child, really, and writing this story in many respects since I was a child. I was first a reporter at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution for many years, covering the civil rights community and milieu there. And then for the past 15 years almost, I've been at the Wall Street Journal as bureau chief and responsible for the southeastern United States. But I'm also a child of the Mississippi Delta. I'm a descendant of Southern whites who, until a few days ago actually, I believed, never owned slaves. That's another story. But fought for the Confederacy and then passed generations on obscure, hungry farms in Alabama, Louisiana, and Arkansas. I was born in the fall of 1964, when the South was convulsing through the darkest years of the civil rights era. Shorner, Goodman, and Cheney had been murdered in Mississippi by the Klan a few months earlier. Within less than a year, black farm workers on a plantation just outside of my town would go on strike in the first farm labor action in the South since the Depression years. They were attacked by the Klan, they were evicted from their homes and set up an encampment nearby, which came to be known as Strike City. And in fact, some of those strikers are still there today. The leader of that group died just a few weeks ago. In 1969, black students at the segregated high school in my town staged a peaceful protest, a march through the center of town, and they were tear gassed by the local police. And a melee ensued, during which a 16-year-old boy was shot by a store owner. Finally, when I entered school in 1970, my class was the first in Mississippi to begin the first grade with black and white children together and in the same classrooms and to go through 12 grades of public education together. As a child, of course, I knew almost nothing of those events. But very early, I found myself questioning why things were the way they were. Why did my family live so differently than the black families in shanties a few blocks away? Why had descendants of the black family that lived on the same land as my grandparents in the 1940s and in the same dire economic straits as my family remained so poor, while I and my brothers emerged so rich by comparison? Why did most of the children at my all-white church not attend my predominantly black school? Why was there so much palpable anger among both whites and African Americans, even 100 years after the Civil War? In the beginning, when I asked those questions and similar ones, it mostly made people unhappy. When I gave a speech in the seventh grade about that farm labor strike in 1965, an event that to my 11-year-old mind was dead ancient history, even though it was barely a decade past, the local Lions Club ended its sponsorship of the town oratorical contest. I later learned that the shop owner who shot the teenager in 1969 was the furious man in the crowd that day who berated me after I gave my remarks. For the record, I did not win. Years later, when I wrote in the Atlanta Constitution about the 10th anniversary of my integrated high school's class graduation and mentioned that riot from 1969, the town's former mayor wrote the editor to say that no one there could recall those events having ever occurred. So I've long had a sharp sense that there is much about our shared past that Americans, particularly white Americans, though to some degree black Americans as well, would rather not remember. I hope that slavery by another name stands in defiance of that national instinct, for it is my unwavering conviction that if our country is ever to fully understand the black-white divide as it still exists today and to forge a shared vision for the future, we must be brutally honest about even the terrible events of our more recent past, even when they touch directly upon our own families and home places or directly challenge the mythologies by which we understand ourselves. We must come to terms with that truth. We have to be willing to document and discuss the reasons, big concrete explanations for why a white family such as mine was emerging from destitution in the years just after World War II and the black family that long lived on that same piece of sandy ground in Jackson Parish, Louisiana, would not. With that, let me share a passage from the introduction of Slavery by Another Name. On March 30th, 1908, Green Cottenham was arrested by the sheriff of Shelby County, Alabama, and charged with the crime of vagrancy. Cottenham had committed no true crime. Vagrancy, the offense of a person not being able to prove at a given moment that he or she is employed, was a new and flimsy concoction, dredged up from legal obscurity at the end of 19th century by the state legislatures of Alabama and the other southern states. It was capriciously enforced by local sheriffs and constables, adjudicated by mayors and notaries public, recorded haphazardly or not at all in court records, and most tellingly, in a time of massive unemployment among all Southern men, was reserved almost exclusively for black men. Cottenham's offense was blackness. After 3 days behind bars, the 22-year-old was found guilty in a swift appearance before the county judge and immediately sentenced to a 30-day term of hard labor. Unable to pay the array of fees assessed on every prisoner, fees to the sheriff, the deputy, the court clerk, the witnesses, his sentence was extended to nearly a year. The next day, Cottenham, the youngest of nine children born to former slaves, was sold. Under a standing arrangement between the county and a vast subsidiary of the industrial titan of the North, U.S. Steel Corporation, the sheriff turned the young black man over to the company for the duration of his sentence. In return, the subsidiary, Tennessee Coal, Iron, and Railroad Company, gave the county $12 a month. What the company's managers did with Cottenham and thousands of other black men they acquired from sheriffs across Alabama was entirely up to them. A few hours later, the company plunged Cottenham into the darkness of a mine called Slope Number 12, one shaft in a vast subterranean labyrinth on the edge of Birmingham known as the Pratt Mines. There, he was chained inside a long wooden barrack at night and required to spend nearly every waking hour digging and loading coal. His required daily task was to remove 8 tons of coal from the mine. Cottenham was subject to the whip for failure to dig the requisite amount, at risk of physical torture for disobedience, and vulnerable to the sexual predations of others, many of whom already had passed years or decades in their own Thonian confinement. The lightless catacombs of black rock, packed with hundreds of desperate men, slick with sweat and coated in pulverized coal, must have exceeded any vision of hell a boy born in the countryside of Alabama, even a child of slaves, could have ever imagined. Waves of disease ripped through the population. In the month before Cottenham arrived at the prison mine, pneumonia and tuberculosis sickened dozens. Within his first 4 weeks, 6 died. Before the year was over, almost 60 men forced into Slope 12 were dead of disease, accidents, or homicide. Most of the broken bodies, along with hundreds of others before and after, were dumped into shallow graves scattered among the refuse of the mine. Others were incinerated in nearby ovens used to blast millions of tons of coal. 45 years after President Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation freeing American slaves, Green Cottenham and more than 1,000 other black men toiled under the lash at Slope 12, imprisoned in what was then the most advanced city of the South, guarded by whipping bosses employed by the most iconic example of the modern corporation emerging in the Gilded North. They were slaves in all but name. This is not an aspect of history many of us have been taught. In fact, most Americans adhere to a fairly simple mythology of racial history. First, there was slavery, then there was the Civil War, then a long, unfortunate time when African Americans were called a bad word, not allowed to vote, held back in some vague way, but where in which time not much really happened. And then Martin Luther King came and fixed things. Even many who have studied 19th and 20th century American history have been taught a version of that era as recorded by white officials at the time, that a wave of lawlessness by freed slaves and their descendants swept across the South after the Civil War, and how freed slaves had difficulty adapting to freedom and independence. Many historians have also accepted that there is little testimony from blacks or other evidence from the time to contradict those assertions, despite the fairly obvious self-interested bias that is inherent to white accounts of the era. Indeed, most Americans and many, many historians have accepted without much question a vague idea that while the fate of blacks in the South early in the 20th century wasn't quite what it ought to have been, it nonetheless wasn't a surprise, certainly not an outrage. The servile status of African Americans has been viewed not as shocking, but as a natural, logical condition. And this long, desperate time, what I call the age of neo-slavery, is seen as something that just happened, the product of black illiteracy and poverty and the bad habits of racist whites who really didn't know any better. The conventional historical interpretation has been to view the events in the early 20th century as a series of disconnected Southern practices that were regrettable for various reasons, but not necessarily all that bad. There are dissertations written on peonage or debt slavery, sharecropping, prison labor. There are scholars, a few scholars, of antebellum industrial slavery, like Tredegar. Much written about racial violence, and some written about political intimidation. Much written, or at least broadly referred to, about the lack of schools for African Americans, about the rise of white supremacy. But each of those aspects of recent Southern history is often treated by historians as each being separate phenomenons, to be sliced and diced and analyzed by regions and periods of time in ways that inadvertently but consistently minimize the totality of the South's and America's regime of coercion against African Americans. And almost every analysis of recent American history fails to see the centrality of forced labor in the great social conspiracy that robbed African Americans of citizenship and grotesquely distorted their efforts to gain education, property, wealth, and political representation. The laws passed to intimidate black men away from political participation were enforced by sending dissidents into slave mines or forced labor camps. The judges and sheriffs who refused to enforce laws that might have protected black families also sold black men to giant corporate prison mines, leased even larger numbers of African Americans to local farmers, and allowed their neighbors and political supporters to acquire still more black laborers directly from their courtrooms. Why are there these omissions? Partly it is simply a failure to tap untouched evidence. Partly it is because this interpretation challenges key pillars of American mythology, such as that Abraham Lincoln ended slavery once and for all. It also is because many have accepted a presumption that it is impossible to reanimate the lives of the impoverished and illiterate millions of African Americans drawn into neo-slavery, or to establish the severity of the limits that it imposed on their lives. So we accept the white version of events of what happened in that time. Perhaps more than anything, we've also all tended to want to see the history of this era primarily in terms of the minority of African Americans who were most able to defy these terrible attacks, the heroic men and women who somehow held their own against this venomous tide, and they were truly heroic figures. But a version of early 20th century history which focuses on those African Americans, on the talented 10th, as Du Bois said, deprives us of a history that truly explains why our society still struggles in some of the ways that it does today. There has been little acknowledgement of the real effects of cycle upon cycle of malevolent defeat, of the injury of seeing one generation rise above the cusp of poverty only to be indignantly crushed, of the impact of repeating tsunamis of violence and obliterated opportunities on each new generation of an ever-changing population outscaled in numbers and resources. About 10 years ago, I began to search in courthouses across the South. What I discovered was that tens of thousands of pages of original records and accounts lie largely untouched. In many cases, enormous repositories of information which haven't been opened except by a few genealogists in decades. They painted a picture of this period of time at the end of the 19th century, not of waves of crime by former slaves and their descendants in the South, but of the capture and imprisonment of thousands of random indigent citizens, almost always under the thinnest chimera of probable cause or judicial process. The total number of workers caught in this net had to have totaled more than 100,000 and perhaps more than twice that figure just in Alabama in one rather narrow period of time. Instead of evidence showing black crime waves, the original records of county jails indicate thousands of arrests for utterly inconsequential charges or for violations of laws, almost all of which are later declared unconstitutional, specifically written to intimidate blacks. Changing employers without permission, vagrancy, selling cotton after dark, walking along rail lines, engaging in sexual activity or loud talk with white women. Repeatedly, the timing and scale of surges in arrests appeared more attuned to rises and dips in the need for cheap labor than any demonstrable acts of crime. Hundreds of forced labor camps came to exist scattered throughout the South, operated by state and county governments, large corporations, small-time entrepreneurs, and provincial farmers. These bulging slave centers became a primary weapon of suppression of black aspiration. Where mob violence or the Ku Klux Klan terrorized black citizens periodically, the return of forced labor as a fixture in black life ground pervasively into the daily lives of millions of African Americans. By 1900, the South's judicial system had been wholly reconfigured to make one of its primary purposes the coercion of African Americans to comply with the social customs and labor demands of whites. It was not coincidental that 1901 also marked the final full disenfranchisement of nearly all blacks throughout the region. Revenues from this neo-slavery poured the equivalent of tens of millions of dollars into the treasuries of Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Georgia, Florida, Texas, North Carolina, and South Carolina, where more than 75% of the black population then lived. On July 31, 1903, a letter to President Theodore Roosevelt arrived at the White House from Carrie Kinsey, a barely literate African-American woman in Bainbridge, Georgia. Her 14-year-old brother, James Robinson, had been abducted a year earlier and sold to a plantation. Local police would take no interest. "Mr. President," wrote Mrs. Kinsey, struggling to overcome the illiteracy of her world, "they won't let me have him. He has not done nothing for them to have him in chains. So I write to you for your help." Like the vast majority of such pleas, and there are more than 30,000 pages of material of this type in the National Archives today, her letter was slipped into a small rectangular folder at the Department of Justice and tagged with a reference number, 12007. No further action was ever recorded. Her letter lies today in the National Archives. The following year, 1904, a new company emerged in Alabama called Pratt Consolidated Coal Company. By 1911, and this is another passage directly from the book, by 1911, it was operating 9 mines on previously undeveloped coal fields north of the Pratt Mines where Green Cottenham died. The company's showcase was the Banner Mine, a deep shaft featuring the first installation of electric lights, cutting tools, and hauling equipment, and the largest prison compound in the South, surrounded by a 15-foot-high wooden stockade. On April 8, 1911, 2 black convicts at the Banner Mine died from inhaling after damp, the noxious combination of carbon monoxide, nitrogen, and other gases left behind when methane vapor ignites in a mine. 1 week later, near dawn on a rainy Saturday morning, just after the day shift of convicts reached their new positions inside Banner, an ignition of blasting powder triggered a massive detonation. A handful of men nearest the initial blast died instantly. The ventilation fan that pushed fresh air deep into the shaft was blown out of position by the force of the explosion. The sudden flash of fire consumed much of the oxygen in the tunnels. And into the chemical vacuum created by the absence of oxygen poured what miners called with terror the black damp, a suffocating mixture of nitrogen and carbon dioxide. About a dozen men still near the 1,700-foot chute leading into the shaft escaped to safety. The rest, 113 black prisoners, the vast majority of them being held for trivial misdemeanors, along with 10 white prisoners and 5 free miners, were killed by the gases. A quickly impaneled coroner's jury certified that the company was using all reasonable means for the prevention of accidents and was not culpable in the deaths. Most of the bodies of the dead were quickly dumped in a long trench dug by other prisoners in the mine's convict cemetery just outside the stockade. Within 2 weeks, the Banner Mine was in operation again with a fresh contingent of black prisoners. Alabama's other slave mines never slowed production in the aftermath of the disaster. Cleve Watts died at prison number 12 on May 22nd, struck in the head with a mining pick. Less than a month later, Lee Lawson was killed in the same mine in a rock fall. On July 29th, Frank Miller was shot to death as he tried to escape number 12. A week later, Jim Miner died in a pickaxe fight at the Flat Top Mine. Ed Gering was crushed, but jammed between 2 cars in number 12 in September 1911. The gruesome fates of all those men and thousands of others ricocheted across the landscape of black life. depositing as they spread new layers of tragedy atop the deep residue of trauma left by thousands of prior horrors from inside and outside the South's forced labor camps. Together, these events formed the foundation of a collective recognition among African Americans of their precarious vulnerability in American society. In the early years after Reconstruction, such news traveled like a telegraph, flashing from one outraged bearer of the word to another. Preachers decried the crimes against innocent men from their pulpits. Before the final ouster of blacks from virtually all Southern elections, African American voters sometimes cast ballots against those who abided the system, in rare cases even forcing a local official out of office, as blacks once did to a sheriff in Chattanooga, Tennessee, after he permitted the lynching of a man from his jail. There were isolated cases when black prisoners collectively refused to work in protest of brutal punishments meted out and of convicts physically attacking their overseers. But such resistance was almost invariably crushed with the sheer force of guns, mob violence, and economic isolation. By the end of the first decade of the 20th century, word of each new outrage moved osmotically, absorbed, often without explicit note, into the shared experience of a black society in which nearly all realistic hope of authentic independence had been shattered. The new slavery of Alabama achieved its zenith. Three massive industrial concerns, U.S. Steel's Alabama Unit, Schloss Sheffield, and now Pratt Consolidated, competed mercilessly for forced laborers. Other industrial concerns stood ready to step in if any major player receded. The system arrived at a cynical optimum of economic harmony, knitting together the interests of capitalists, white farmers, local sheriffs, and judges, and advocates of the most cruel white supremacy, all joined and served by an unrelenting pyramid of intimidation. The companies, producing nearly 15 million tons of coal annually by 1910, held more than 3,000 black men against their will in Alabama's mines at all times, creating a bulwark against labor unrest and an enormous economic subsidization to their most critical cost of production. Hundreds more African Americans worked in Southern Alabama timber and turpentine camps operated by a range of businesses, a textile mill in Prattville, and many other concerns across Alabama and across the South. Hundreds more, no one kept count, were parceled out by local sheriffs to farmers and businessmen scattered across the South. The reality of incarceration in the slave mines became so ubiquitously understood for African American men that landlords and local sheriffs, equipped with almost unchecked powers of arrest and conviction and enormous financial interest in providing labor to the mines and other enterprises, could make almost any demand upon any black man. More often than any other, that demand was that they remain on the land of specific white farmers, living lives of supposedly voluntary serfdom, or as prisoners sentenced to that fate. Across the Black Belt of Alabama in 1910, more than 90,000 African American families lived in the darkness of that oppression. A world in which the seizure and sale of a black man, even a black child, was viewed as neither criminal nor extraordinary, had reemerged. Millions of blacks lived in that shadow as forced laborers, their family members, or African Americans in terror of the system's caprice. The practice would not begin to fully recede from their lives until the dawn of World War II. One chapter of the book is focused on Atlanta, where I live, and how the origins of the modern Atlanta are rooted deeply in this form of forced labor. And it focuses on two particular figures who really are the fathers of modern Atlanta and fathers of the sort of corporate regime of Atlanta today. One was a mayor of the city in the 1880s, named James English, who had a brick-making concern on the outskirts of the city that made millions and millions of bricks that were purchased by the city of Atlanta and by builders of the city. Those bricks were used to pave the sidewalk in front of my house today. I'm certain those bricks are in the chimneys and in the footings of my house, which was built in 1906. They paved the streets of the city. They are literally the bricks that Atlanta stands on even today. And they were all made by slave laborers working under these circumstances. The other character from that time is a man named Joel Hurt, who is famous as a real estate developer and a kind of visionary builder in the city. He built the neighborhood adjacent to mine in Atlanta. But less known is that he was also an owner of enormous slave mines in North Alabama and timber camps that relied on these forced laborers. And so as you get toward the end of the book, in the epilogue, there's a series of dialogues between me and various living people who connect in one way or another to these events, either to the families or the individuals who accumulated great wealth, or to the victims of this system. And all of those conversations that I had with those people and others, the conversation that I have today, even the, you know, perhaps brutal remarks one might make about hallowed graduates of UVA are not intended to be embarrassing or to make uncomfortable people who are alive today, because I'm very clear in the book that no person can be tainted by the actions of a distant forebear, no matter how questionable they may have been. But I do maintain that if we're to find the best way forward in America, we must know this history. We must confront it. We must accept the enormous scale of it. We must acknowledge the injury that it left behind and how that those injuries still affect us today. Since the book came out, I've and miraculously for such a long, grim story, it's had a big audience. And so I've heard from hundreds of readers. I particularly heard from many, many African-American families who tell me that the book finally brings some context, some sensibility to stories that they already know, things that they have always intuited. I say that African-Americans know this story in their hearts, whether they know the exact details of it or not. But so many times, I suspect it will happen today, a young African-American person or a middle-aged African-American will tell me that there was this story that my grandmother used to tell, or that my great-grandmother told before she died 20 years ago, the story of the farm in South Georgia that she said they couldn't leave and where they were never paid. And I would say, Mama, that's not possible, because you're talking about the 1940s, or you're talking about the early 1950s, and slavery had been over, you know, for almost 100 years. And she would say it again, and then finally she would just stop telling the story. And people will tell me that now I see how that story fits into the context of all of this. But I've also gotten a lot of fascinating response from whites. I'd like to, as I close, read an email that came a few weeks after the book came out. It sums up some of this better than I can. Dear Mr. Blackman, I am the great-great-granddaughter of Joel Hurt, one of the Atlanta figures. I have only just discovered your book. I have found everything possible about it on the web, including this fascinating website. I'm trying to muster the courage to read your book. Just reading excerpts has been quite painful. Needless to say, this is a very emotional subject for us, as we did not know any of this before. But in the meantime, I am writing because I want to thank you simply for having written it. I've had that same photo of great-great-grandfather hanging on my wall for years and have always been proud of his participation in rebuilding Atlanta after the Civil War. But I believe that the ghosts of slavery and racism and the terrorism inflicted within our own country must not be hidden away, but brought out into the open. I'm so grateful to you for allowing me to learn more of the truth of my family's past. Without the whole truth, we live only in illusions. And I would hate to live my life perpetuating illusions, especially such horrific ones whose ramifications continue today. I remain proud of where I come from, but humbled by the realities that you have brought to light. Thank you. And I thank you for coming out today.
Doug, let me prime the pump, if I may. Your book, your story, ends with World War II. Where and in what forms does neo-slavery persist?
Even today?
Even today.
Well, I'm not sure that the neo-slavery that I write about, particularly as it pertains to African Americans, does exist today. Now, certainly, and I suspect there are people in the audience who have views on this, certainly these events tell us much about why things are the way they are today, why the economic divide and educational divide between blacks and whites exists as it does today. But the actual form of enslavement that I talk about here, I think, is a different thing from the controversy over the prison industrial complex. But it is a big part of how America got into the habit of having a large percentage of the African American population incarcerated. And I think it is a part of the explanation for why our society is so comfortable in many respects with the idea that such a large percentage of that group of people remains imprisoned. But I also think that there are haunting parallels between some of the mechanisms of neo-slavery and the way that many immigrant workers live their lives in the United States today. And certainly there are echoes of this neo-slavery all around the world in other places. There are brick factories in Pakistan today that are identical, for all intents and purposes, to the one on the outskirts of Alabama at the beginning of the 20th century.
In terms of our community moving towards racial healing, could you comment on the psychological development of racial superiority and if we should look at that in the context of mental health in both races?
Well, I'm not an expert on mental health, but I will say that the events of this book are intrinsically related to the emergence of the kind of white, sort of the ideology and structure of white supremacy that we, as we understand it today, the sort of Nazi-like notions of white supremacy that began to emerge at the end of the 19th century in the U.S. and that were really different from the racial views that predated the Civil War. And that's another much larger conversation. But the sort of sinister notions of genetic inferiority and superiority that anchor notions of white supremacy emerged at the same time that these mechanisms were emerging as vehicles for the oppression of African Americans. And so there's absolutely a link between the two, and there's absolutely a link between the humiliation and terror of these events at the beginning of the 20th century and the effect that that did have in a kind of in a broadly social way on African Americans. And one of the reasons why this story is unfamiliar to many people, and that's not to say it has never been written about in any way, but I think it has not been written about in this way before, but one of the reasons it's unfamiliar to us is because African Americans themselves helped to suppress these stories as a mechanism of protecting one generation from the traumas of a previous generation. And I think that the sort of psychological impact of that over time has to be very profound. Now, I will leave it to someone with more technical expertise to investigate that, but I think that's absolutely a part of the story of how, not just how things are, but how we think, both black and white, today.
Mr. Blackman, I wonder if you'd address the issue of remedies. I realize that many of these people have passed from the scene. There are perhaps no individual remedies, but the neo-slavery you describe was the product of state legislatures. Should state legislatures like Alabama or Mississippi fashion some remedy for the wrongness that we inflicted on black people? And does the federal government have a role here? And if you don't think that these remedies should be fashioned by the legislature, you could tell us why.
Well, I actually say in the epilogue of the book, I actually say that this is not a call for reparations. Now, I think I say it's also not in opposition of reparations. Now, that's a classic dodge of a difficult question, and I freely admit to that, because I think the reparations, particularly in the context that we've discussed them in the last 10 years, I think are extraordinarily complex, difficult to talk about in sound bites. But I also feel that there's a necessary starting point, and that's what I'm really focused on, is that I think that one of the reasons why we are confused about any discussion of remedy in the context of contemporary national discourse. We're confused in all of that because we're under the mistaken impression, for instance, that slavery ended 150 years ago. That immediately gives, that affects our ability to discuss whether there should be any kind of remedy for any kind of social ill that has a black-white division to it. And that's why all of us have been in conversations in which someone says, why are black people still complaining? They've had 150 years to get over slavery. Why do we have to keep doing these things? We've all been in that conversation. And of course, they haven't had 150 years. They've had maybe 50 years. There are thousands and thousands of African Americans who are alive today who were born into a state of de facto slavery. Now, happily, you know, it began to crack up by the time they were adults. Nonetheless, they were born into that. That legacy is still an active part of living America. It is not an ancient dead thing. And so I think that before we can get to the remedies, we have to come to a more clinical, honest understanding of the injuries. And so that's really what I'm about, is that focus. Where we go from there, you know, how we remedy these things, and obviously they need to be remedied, for the good of all of us, for the good of our society, they need to be remedied. The specific mechanisms of that I'm less certain about, except that I will say the ways in which America tried to remedy things over the last 35 years, the simple mechanisms of affirmative action and related efforts by the government, which in reality, contrary to most of our national discourse, have not been expensive, have not significantly injured whites, have not set back large numbers of white Americans in any meaningful way, but did have fantastic effect on liberating the potential and aspirations of African Americans, and are a part of why when you honestly reset the clock, when you realize that the African American recovery from slavery in economic terms really didn't begin until the 1950s, 60s, maybe even the 1970s, when you judge things in that manner, mathematically, what we've experienced is the most extraordinary surge in wealth and achievement, perhaps of any group of people in all of human history. What has happened in the last 35 years in terms of African Americans? And when we reframe that discussion and are honest about the past and the lingering injuries from it, then I think we'll end up at a different kind of conversation about what the remedies are.
Well, let's hope so. My question is commenting on the title of your book. As we, you know about the mortgage and credit crisis and things that are going on, African Americans, black Americans, what have you, are targeted for predatory lending practices and things like that. Do you feel this might be by design in slavery in another form or by another name?
Yeah, it's I'm often questioned, asked about that. And you know, one of the difficulties of writing a book like this that relates to so many things in society is that I get a lot of questions about, you know, isn't this thing in the present, you know, that same thing? My answer to that, in terms specifically predatory lending and those are things which I believe, and actually in my work at the Wall Street Journal, completely separate from this, I've been very involved in a lot of analysis of subprime lending practices. And in fact, I and another person in the journal did probably the most comprehensive data analysis of subprime loans all across the country that's been done by anybody, involving millions and millions of mortgages. And I'll be honest with you, I went into it very much so looking for the evidence of a kind of explicit effort to steer African Americans into the most damaging kinds of loans. And we had difficulty finding that. Now, what we did find, though, was that poor people universally were steered into those kinds of loans. And so then that gets you this question of, well, is there a kind of hidden racial aspect, you know, a non-explicit racial aspect to it? And perhaps there is. But I think that much of that is really more about an abuse of those who are poorer and less sophisticated generally than an explicit racial thing. And in a perverse way, that perhaps is a sign of progress, because I do think it's the case that as specific racial venom and racial animosity declines in our society, and it has, that's an indisputable thing, as evidenced by the extraordinary moment in history that we're living in today, and the national discourse and the elections that are going on, there's no doubt that the racial animosity has declined dramatically. And so the human instinct to abuse takes on fewer and fewer racial characteristics and more class and economic characteristics, in my view.
Along those lines, as somebody who studies the contemporary criminal justice system and crime policy, I'm really struck by a parallel today. It's very understudied that several states have on the books and in their Department of Corrections what's called user fees that are assessed. Virginia is one of them. That are assessed on prisoners for room and board, right? So if you're incarcerated, you're paying inmate fees that are assessed over time and can accumulate. And when released from prison, you are required to pay back the state, pay back these user fees. Many of these, and there aren't studies of this, but anecdotally, people are brought and reincarcerated for being indigent and not being able to repay what they owe the state for their own incarceration. So that somebody who might have been incarcerated for a victimless drug offense or a small-time property offense, a misdemeanor even, can be then based on these punitive mechanisms, reincarcerated for much longer stints of time. Could you talk about the connections there? Could you talk about, you know, what your story lends to contemporary narratives of black criminality?
Sure. And I'm no expert on those specific laws of today, but I will tell you that all across the law books and the case law, particularly of the South, there are vestiges of all of this that continue today in many, many respects. And the fee system, and almost every Southern state had the fee system, that's clearly a residue of the old fee system. One of the things that we forget is how little taxation there was 100 years ago, how little money there was in the coffers, particularly of state governments. And so one of the responses to that was that very few local officials were paid a salary of any kind. And so the fee system emerged as a way to finance local government, essentially. And so the sheriff and the deputy sheriff and most of local officialdom, their compensation was 100% based on the fees that were charged, like the fees you're describing today, the fees that Greene Cottenham couldn't pay in 1908. But in addition to that, an even more nefarious aspect of that was the sheriffs in almost every Southern state, though I'm off the top of my head, I'm not certain if Virginia was one, almost every Southern state, the state government would pay a sheriff a certain amount per day, 25 or 35 cents a day, for the feeding of prisoners that they held in their jail. But there was no particular accounting of that money. And so a sheriff, typically his wife, would cook the food for the jail. And so the feeding fees that would come into a sheriff, that was simply his compensation. And what it actually cost to feed the prisoners didn't really matter. He'd keep the difference between the actual cost and the money that came in. And so the combination of the fees and the feeding fees created a situation in which sheriffs were incentivized to arrest as many people as possible and to feed them as little as possible. And so what you ended up with were county jails all over the South that were filled with absolutely starving, naked men. That's the reality, who were then sold after a period of time, unclothed, unfed, in horrible physical condition oftentimes. I mean, the county jail, a black man going into a county jail in Alabama or anywhere else in the Deep South in 1905 lived in absolute terror of the county jail in particular, because it was a place of starvation and absolute deprivation. And the shorter the period of time that they would be held in the county jail, the better, because they knew. And so Greene Cottenham, for instance, because he was only in the jail for 3 days, he emerged actually healthier than the other, the 10 or 11 men who were sold along with him that day to U.S. Steel. Several of them had been there for several weeks waiting for the company's labor agent to come around and make the regular pickup of laborers. And so they were in much worse condition. Some of them died much faster once they got to the mines. But so this tradition of fee-based government service, fees in the incarceration system, this idea that prisoners should be made to pay for their own incarceration, since it's their fault that they got incarcerated, that logic. There's a long tradition of that. And the current version of it seems much more antiseptic than the real origins of it 100 years ago.
Can you comment on the extent to which slavery may be continuing to affect what seems to be our inability to evaluate the cost of labor in America, which may be causing the great loss of jobs we're seeing in almost the entire manufacturing sector?
Yeah, that's a complicated economic equation that I'm not sure I can give you a good answer to. I will say, though, that we shouldn't throw the word slavery around lightly. And there's a difference between slavery and terrible abuse, you know, or terrible unfairness. Those are different things. And I think we do have, in the current economic system, there are, in fact, the value of labor, how to value labor, the many of the challenges of economic policy and labor policy are caught up in very difficult questions about the valuation of labor. And there are aspects of the system today which I'm sure are archly unfair. But that is not necessarily slavery. You know, slavery, as I talk about it, is an identifiable group of people who find themselves bought and sold and forced to labor without compensation. And many historians, even today, certainly in the past, would have argued that what I write about here is not slavery, that even what I describe as neo-slavery is not slavery. And that argument is that because these were people who were, in some cases, convicted of crimes, whether ostensible or not, that and because the slavery ended after a period of time, did not necessarily pass from one generation to the next, that means it wasn't slavery. In fact, none of those caveats are part of the definition of slavery, either technically or logically. But the reality was that this is slavery. What I describe is absolutely slavery. And we cannot deny the title of slaves to these victims any more than we can deny that to the forced workers of the Holocaust, who could be said not to have been slaves because they had been declared criminals by the German state. This was slavery, and I am a little protective, in a sense, of that these victims of slavery, and so I think we have to differentiate terrible abuse from slavery.
Hi. Given the history exposed in your book and its continuing effects upon African Americans today, do you think there's still a need for specifically educational affirmative action policies in this country? And if so, why do you think there's been a push over the last couple of years to rescind some of these policies?
Well, being a journalist, I try not to take really obvious positions of advocacy, but I will say that anybody who thinks that there's not still value or need or justice in affirmative action type programs in education, anybody who doesn't think that is crazy. It's just flatly crazy. That's just an obvious reality. And why has there been an attack on it? Well, why has all of this slipped from our collective memory? Because we want to believe that we have progressed further than we have. I mean, that's the innocent explanation, and I think that is much of the explanation. But it's also very advantageous to some groups in our society to argue that that in fact whites have become victims. It's much more fun to be a victim than an oppressor. You know, that's a much more satisfying place to create for yourself in the national mythology. And so I think that by repositioning affirmative action in education as an abuse of whites rather than as a remedy for blacks, then the argument begins to make sense in some respects that, we need to stop this because we have a level playing field today. Slavery's been over for 150 years. We're back into that whole set of presumptions and suppositions, which I think are powerfully undercut by my book, I hope. But I think those are the explanations.
You mentioned some court documents that detail these cases. Are there similar company documents? And if so, is there an effort to cover up within the documents? And also, as a separate question, have you had any response from some of the possible descendants of these companies to your charges?
Yeah, excuse me. In the epilogue of the book, there are conversations with several people connected back to the corporations and or to some of these family businesses. In particular, there's a long discourse. It's actually the only uplifting part of the book is a conversation between me and the, at the time, CEO of Wachovia Bank, who was ousted a few weeks ago as a part of the current financial crisis. But Wachovia is I had to bring Wachovia into the book because there had to be something positive. You know, there had to be some path out at the end of this long, grim story. And Wachovia is interesting because it is a descendant, in a manner of speaking, from a bank started by Mayor English, that figure in Atlanta from the 1880s. And so Wachovia is made up of many institutions of the past. One of the largest components of Wachovia was this bank in Atlanta that was founded with the wealth that came from the brick factory that I described, as was the modern Coca-Cola Company and any number of others. But Wachovia was forced several years ago, sort of at the height of the reparations discussion, the city of Chicago passed an ordinance requiring every company that does business with the city to disclose any connections that it had in its past to antebellum slavery. And it's the only city in the country that has done that and effectively forced it to actually happen. And so Wachovia did a lot of business with the city of Chicago and was compelled to do this. Initially, the CEO, his response to that, because Ken Thompson is a good guy from North Carolina, you know, middle-aged guy, white guy from North Carolina, who thinks all the right things and believes, you know, the things that he ought to believe in modern society, but also had not thought much about race, had been really focused on other things, as the CEO of a Wachovia would have been. And so when this came up, his initial reaction was, this is crazy. This is Jesse Jackson nonsense. You know, why do we have to go through this? It's a stunt, was his initial reaction. And Wachovia, the entity called Wachovia, didn't even exist before the Civil War. So why would the entity called Wachovia today, you know, have to go back and investigate antebellum slavery? So his initial reaction was very negative. But he was convinced by subordinates that, no, we really need to do this. One, we want to keep the business, but also maybe we just need to do it. And so they go through this process, because once you start a process like that, you have to do it very well, or someone like me will come along and embarrass you. And so they did a very thorough investigation of all this and found, of course, all sorts of ties to antebellum slavery, all kinds of things. You know, they were mostly through banks that they had acquired in the North, who had loaned money against slaves being brought into the United States, issued insurance policies against slaves, all kinds of connections, but also many Southern banks that had connections as well. And so they put all this together. When they got ready to disclose it, Thompson was still terrified of what the response would be. The reparations movement was still very active. He was certain there'd be lawsuits against them. But most of all, he was concerned that the thousands of African Americans who worked for Wachovia would be infuriated by this, and that this would be a terrible thing inside the company. Nonetheless, they proceeded. They did the standard things. They set up a scholarship program, you know, to set aside some money for that. They gave some money to some foundations, you know, a number of things. But then they did this big disclosure of what they had found. And the first disclosure was in a meeting with the African American Employees Association, something like that. And Thompson went into the meeting absolutely certain it would be a disaster, and then disclosed the findings, you know, in a very formal sort of way. And this sounds Pollyanna-ish, what I'm about to describe, but I believe it to be true in the same way that I believe the impossibly gruesome things that I also describe in the book that seem impossible. But in reality, what happened in that meeting was African Americans in the room began to cry, came up, embraced him, began embracing each other. There was this kind of liberating experience, common experience between whites and blacks, about that finally the truth was being told, the truth was being shared. The company was able to be honest about its past, a past that African Americans were certain they knew in their hearts without the details, and that whites at the company were certain could never have happened. And in the disclosure of the actual facts, same way that I hope my book is a disclosure of the actual facts, there was actually a fairly marvelous moment of healing. Now, maybe everything went to hell right after that. I don't know. But there's a value to that. So Wachovia is the most optimistic story of, and we'll see if it exists a week from now, but Wachovia was the most optimistic version of that. U.S. Steel, which is perhaps the great villain, corporate villain in the book, was somewhat responsive. I mean, when I first talked to them about these topics, it was almost 10 years ago, and their response 10 years ago was what you would expect from a very insular, dying, you know, rusting industrial concern. It's a different company today, and I think they are, you know, though they did not comment again, they chose not to comment again at the end of the process. I actually think if they had, they would have had a much more nuanced, much more sophisticated understanding of these things. As far as the records are concerned, this unit of U.S. Steel that existed in Alabama, still exists today on paper, and which once employed 50 or 60,000 people in Alabama. It existed as a company from the 1850s to the present, but as an active corporation from the 1850s to the 1950s. During that period of time, it had hundreds of thousands of employees. It had slave mines in Tennessee before the Civil War and slave mines in Alabama after the Civil War. I mean, long, long history. Millions of pages of records were obviously created by that company, all of which, according to U.S. Steel today, no longer exist, which is impossible for me to really accept. I was able to locate a lot of company records, mostly on eBay, by searching and searching for years on end and buying anything that popped up on eBay that mentioned the name of that company. I ended up with a lot of stuff that had gone home with a retiree and been in the garage for 30 years, and eventually I found some letter books in private collections that people had, and so I was eventually able to assemble a good deal more information than U.S. Steel itself believed existed. And those records are somewhere, and they would tell us interesting things, and maybe they will surface. And in fact, there was a historian who in the 60s had access to them and wrote a fairly brilliant, if racist, dissertation about the history of that company at the time. But sometime between the mid-60s and now, they've come to not exist. But perhaps they'll resurface someday.
If we're going to have a more just tomorrow, we have to look deeply into our history, and we have to be willing to discuss it in forums like this. We are deeply grateful to Doug Blackman for his work, and for today, putting the hay down where even the blind goats can find it. Thank you.
Thank you.